Today we talk to a man who knows a good song when he writes one. He's penned hits for the likes of Kygo and Miguel, Little Mix and Lewis Capaldi, to name just a few. And in his spare time manages to tour the world as an artist in his own right. Amongst all this, he's managed to find some precious time to talk to me today. Welcome to Hype Club, Phil Plessid.
How are you? Yes, it's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Ray Fawns. How are you doing in lockdown at the moment? I have to ask.
I think it's different. It's obviously not ideal. I'll always kind of want to write with someone face to face. You'll never be able to beat that. But I think I love this industry because everyone kind of shows that whatever happens, we can kind of find a way to create, you know, and we can still make the art that we want to make. I've been doing a lot of stuff with other artists while I'm here. And it's kind of been nice because everyone's a lot more, how can I best describe this? Everyone's a bit more like patient with it. You know, when you write songs, it's obviously like everyone's just chiseling away, trying to find the right ideas and the things that are going to work. But I think with this and just like, it's out of everyone's hands. So everyone's just kind of like, let's just have a bit of fun, get online, have a chat, see what we come up with. And if we come up with something good, then it's kind of like a bonus, you know? This is going to change writing songs forever. I think it cuts out the whole, like, wherever you are in the world. Like, I don't have to fly to LA to work with people from LA now, you know? And I think it was almost like we had to be forced into that situation to kind of play that card, which is really interesting. And there's definitely something to be said for kind of being mid-session, and then you go downstairs for a snack and then my parents are there and I could just have a chat with my parents and then go back to the session. It's amazing.
Going back a little bit into your history, speaking of where you're in Rickmansworth right now, right? Is that right?
Yeah. Well, just outside of Rickmansworth. So I'm kind of between Rickmansworth and Watford in a little town called Croxley Green.
And that's so basically, for listeners, I'm sure no one's going to care about this, but that is where my mum grew up as well. And so we have some sort of geographical connection there.
Indeed.
So music for you, just explain a little bit about this, because friendships in music have been a big thing for you, and you grew up with a lot of friends who ended up being musical collaborators. So just tell us how that started and take us back a little bit in Phil Plessid's musical.
Yes. So I first started music because my granddad plays guitar, basically. And my parents were the type of parents that were like, we want you to learn an instrument from a young age. And I did the classic, like, started on recorder, and then I did violin, and then I did clarinet, and nothing kind of like gave me that, like, yes, I'm doing this. So when I saw my granddad playing guitar, I was just like, oh, I really want to do that. And when I went to secondary school, I basically picked up the guitar, started doing lessons. Meanwhile, at that school, so it was Rickmansworth School, big up, love that place. I'd been friends with a guy called Matt Holmes since I was a kid, since I was about 3 years old. We've been best friends. But we both went to Ricky School. We met Hanan, who is our now manager. We met Phil Lee, who is in a collaboration with Matt. They have Mac and Phil. And a guy called Kane, who produces under the name Kin and writes songs and is an artist himself. We basically were the kids at school that at lunchtime, everyone would go play football. We'd just go and find the piano, sit around the piano and just talk about music and play really bad songs. But we just kind of like created this bubble of like, we really trusted in each other and we were like emotional with each other. We could kind of like connect, which not a lot of other people were doing at the time. And we just bonded, and then it kind of went from there. All the guys did music tech, which was one of the lessons that was available. I didn't do that because I thought music was impossible. I thought you're never going to get into the music industry. There is a big iron wall that you're never going to get past. So I went to art school. I spent all my time doing art, and music was just a hobby, and I did illustration. Oh, wow. But when we left school, a guy called Naughty Boy, who is the UK producer, he basically came to the school. He knows Hanan. He's like a family friend. And he basically came to check out a couple of us because we were performing at the talent show. And at the time, I think he'd only had a couple of songs out. So he isn't Naughty Boy as we know him now. He was just like a guy called Naughty Boy from Watford that was showing up to our school. And he just came and watched us sing some songs and was just like, come to the studio. Like, we'll go and write some songs, see how it goes. Like, we could just experiment. And I kind of went, told my mom, I was like, this guy called Naughty Boy wants me to go to his studio. And she was like, thankfully she let me go. And And we kind of all just went, like, kind of one by one, we ended up getting into the studio, and then we just kind of cemented our kind of musical bond at F Block, which is like the music studios in Ealing. So me, Mac and Phil, Ken, we're all managed by Hanan, and we still create together. And it's been an amazing journey, really.
Going back briefly to what you were saying about how there's this big iron wall around music. And I remember my my A-level English teacher saying to me, she said, because I was considering going to uni.
Yep.
And I thought, oh, there's no way for me to ever get into the music business. So maybe I'll be a music critic. And this is like about 12 years ago. So I think, really.
Yeah.
So, and she said, yeah, just do music as a hobby and do English as a degree. And ironically, I had my first hits when I was at uni. So doing English.
There you go.
So I proved everyone wrong. But it's one of those things. It is really, really difficult. And that's a theme that's come up doing this podcast series already, like how difficult it is. And I guess Naughty Boy, just having a connection with your friend Hanan, like managing just to, you know, coming into school, watching you perform and stuff. And then suddenly there's like a chink in that iron wall and you can get through.
That's it. Yeah.
You ended up in a band with them and stuff. So how did that end up? And was that was, I guess, your first musical, professional musical?
Completely. Yeah, so that was that moment at school when Naughty Boy came to see us. There was a girl called Grace as well, and she was a couple of years below us at school, but we all knew her, and she was kind of like the talent at the school. She had an amazing voice. Naughty Boy was basically like, look, like, you guys should make a band. We'll write some songs, as I said, and we'll kind of, we'll see how that goes. So we called the band Saving Grace at first. We had some like legal stuff with like a Christian rock band, so we were just like, okay, you do your thing. So we changed the name to Chasing Grace, and we basically, being in Naughty Boy studio at the time, he was making the Emily Sande album, Sam Smith was in and out, he had all these artists coming in for his own album, Hotel Cabana, and there were a few labels and publishers coming in. So we met Darkus, who was heading up the UK side of Ireland at that point. Sang some songs to him, which was probably the scariest thing I've ever done in my life, because he was just standing there in the room, and we're just like, and we ended up getting signed to Ireland. Like, I guess this is like the wrong way to put it, but it almost happened too easy. We kind of got into the music industry. We'd written a few songs. We got signed to my dream label. This was at a time when it was like Ben Howard and Mumford & Sons of Ireland. And I was just like, what? But we had like the most amazing 3 years, 3 or 4 years. So it was me, Matt and Phil and Grace. And we just basically like played gigs. We wrote songs. It was my first introduction to kind of like the artist side of the industry, you know, which is like a very different side to writing. Sure. A very, very different thing. So that was an amazing experience, just to kind of understand how shows worked, how rehearsing worked, and festivals and stuff like that. I think it was after about 3 years, we'd written one album. And we basically got the call that no one wants to get, where the label were basically like, look, it's not quite working how we want it to. So we're going to have to like end our relationship and put the album out and everything like that. And it was kind of like the perfect chapter of my life. It was the introduction. We got an album out, and then we left the label. And at that point, I kind of had to have a conversation with myself and decide what I wanted to do in this industry, because as you say, it's very hard, and you obviously want to make a career out of it. And I think an artist, in an artist world, it's a lot more of a risk, because you're putting everything into it at all times. So I sat down with the guys and I was like, look, I think I just want to write songs for a bit. Maybe we should put the band on a break and just kind of go our own ways for a little bit and see what happens. So that's what we did. And that, unfortunately, was the end. At the moment, it was the end of Chasing Grace, but what a time. It was the perfect kind of just chapter of music, really.
You seem very philosophical about it, but I can imagine that maybe if you were even a bit young or something, it might have been sort of, you might have looked at it and thought, this is the end of music, you know. And like you said, it came too easy. And that's a phrase I don't hear often from a lot of people. People say, I worked and I struggled, blah, 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 and I trying to get, you know, people say, I was trying to get signed, you know, people try to get signed their whole lives and stuff, and it never happens. And you sort of walk into a record deal almost. So when you sort of put the phone down at the end of that call, were you thinking, okay, this is it, it's over? Or were you thinking, no, I'm going to do this. I'm going to make it out of this and make something of myself.
In this industry, you have to work for it. There's no two ways about it. You have to put the graft in. And I think having that whole situation, getting signed to a dream label and then getting dropped, it was the biggest wake up call of my life. And it was probably the best thing that happened to me, because it made me realize that this isn't easy, and you do have to put the work in. So when we got to that point, I was just like, right, I was like, this is it now, heads down. I have to go for it and run with it, and I have to make a thing of this. So at that point, I used it as like fuel to kind of get there, you know. Yeah. I was like, let's go.
Yeah. So what was your first non-Chasing Grace songwriting session? You know, you turn up to work on the Monday after you get dropped kind of thing. And what was it that happened?
I feel like me, Mac and Phil did a lot of work together at that point, just to kind of see what it was like writing pop songs, you know. I had like a really early cut that happened kind of out of my hands, but there was a song that I'd written and James Arthur took it on his first album. It was called Certain Things. That was my first taste of like getting a cut with someone else and someone a lot bigger singing your song, which is an amazing feeling. So I was just kind of like, that was cool, so let's try and do that again.
Yeah, right.
As you probably know, it's like you kind of write songs every day and you know that not all of these songs are going to get used. If one song might get used out of a whole year of writing, you know, so.
And that's important. It's important. I just want to interrupt you quickly because that's important for people to hear. It's not as if you're on a construction line building parts of an airplane that are going into that airplane in the next day, you know, and that's going to become an airplane and take off into the sky. Mm. Like a lot of what we do, as you say, is you may as well just throw some of it in the bin sometimes, you know. That's what it feels like anyway.
Completely. I think we were kind of the sense of we were having a bit of fun, you know. We had this freedom all of a sudden where we didn't have to worry about rehearsals next week or we have a gig next week. It was just like we're in the studio together and we're just kind of experimenting, and it was a great time. And it took about 2 years of writing non-stop, like all day all night, to get my first next song out. I guess with Instagram and stuff, no one sees the kind of work behind all of this. You know, they see the songs that come out and that go to radio or whatever, but they don't see the songs that the like 150 songs that are just like on my hard drive that are not very good. You know, some of them that I write by myself are just like awful. But you have to write those songs, you know, to get the good ones. Yeah. I always say that I think it's a bit like the lottery. Every day you write a song and it's like buying a lottery ticket, right? You kind of, you just write it and then you've got that forever. And then one day someone might hear it and be like, ah, the magic numbers. And then you're kind of like, oh, sick. Crazy. Cool. That 2 years, I wrote some great songs, but the one that really stood out was when I wrote Touch for Little Mix, which was my first. It went to radio. My parents were like, oh, this is what you've been doing this whole time. So yeah, that was a great moment.
Crazy. And when that chart got announced and stuff, what was the feeling? What was the feeling like?
It was a feeling that I'd never felt before. I think it was a moment of proving to myself that you could actually do this and you could make something of it. Money aside, like I'm not a big person that thinks about money. I just really enjoy the music industry and I'm a bit of a nerd for it. So like, just the idea that it was being played on radio however many times a day, for me, like the thought of that and how many people were hearing the song was incredible. And people knew the words. I'd go to like parties and people would be playing it and like singing along. And obviously, as you know, like that feeling like is indescribable. I was like, hang on a second, this is mental.
I've spoken to different people about this and I think people have different reactions to when they hear their song on the radio and when they go to a party or when they go to a gig and see it performed. Did you ever get to the point where you were turning the radio on and having to turn the song off, or were you just like, no, this is crazy, like still?
I feel like for me it was actually a feeling of like you could actually relax and listen to the song. Yeah. Because every time I'd heard it before, which was probably like 1,000 times, trying to get the lyrics right and the mix and the production, and you're kind of analyzing constantly. And then you get to this point where it's just on radio and you're like, oh, I can actually just sit back and listen to this as a song, like right, without having to think, oh, we can make this better, you know. Oh, it's kind of like, is there, I'm like the world's biggest pessimist as well. Like literally I just don't think anything's good that I do. I'm just like, oh, it's rubbish. So when it went on radio, I was just like, oh, there is a light at the end of the tunnel. I was like, I'm doing something right. So yeah, it was really cool. So I would do the opposite. Every time I come on, I just turn it up. So it's like, enjoy the moment, because it's not going to happen a lot, you know?
You've weaved in and out of writing for other people and stuff, and we'll come back to that in a second. But when did you then decide, no, I want to do this artist thing again? And how did that come about? And was that through songwriting? And yeah, just tell us about that.
Yeah, so Touch happened. And that was, as I said, like, that was like the, oh, okay, like, this is cool. Something's going right. Maybe I can make a career out of this. And then another 2 years kind of went by, and I was just writing. Kind of that song opened some doors for me. So I was working with some like people like in my dream list, you know, of people to work with. So I was like, I was loving it. And then basically all that happened is I had a few songs that I didn't want to give away, which was an interesting one, because I was like, I didn't really want to be an artist, but at the same time, I just didn't want to, like, some songs are too personal to give away, and they kind of connect with you on another level. So I kind of was creating this kind of project at the side that I had no idea of like putting out or anything like that. And then I kind of sat down with Hanan, and he was like, what do you want to do with these songs? Because if you don't want to give them to anyone and you sound good on them, like, why not put them out? Like, Spotify's there. All these streaming services are there for you to do this, you know, like never before. So I was kind of like, interesting. That kind of planted the seed. And then I got to a point where I actually missed playing gigs, which was the second kind of like, okay, this is like a feeling of maybe I should be an artist again. So I literally just put a couple of songs out just to gauge a reaction. There was a song called IOU and a song called Habits. Mm-hmm. And Habits, just to tie everything up, like Habits I did with Mac and Phil and Kane. And we put that on Spotify, and it got a million streams.
Amazing.
So I was just like, okay, interesting. Like, so everything was saying, try it, be an artist again. At that point, I had a song called The Least That I Could Do, which is now out in the world. But we had that kind of on the hard drive for a very long time. We knew that it was special. And it was one of the original songs I didn't want to give away. I went to LA and I met a guy called Mike Caron, who is the head of a label called APG, who have some amazing artists. And I went to his house and we kind of played some songs. And at the time, I was actually going just as a writer. I just wanted to play some demos to get some sessions with his artists. And I played The Least That I Could Do. And he kind of stopped it. And he was like, are you not an artist? Like, is that not a thing? And I was just like, I was like, well, and I explained this whole thing. And he was like, no, he was like, you're an artist. Definitely an artist. And then about a week later, like, we flew out to New York and met Atlantic. We met Craig Kelman, and he kind of like solidified it. He was like, we really think that this is a thing. Like, you shouldn't give these songs away. And then there was an offer on the table from APG, and it took me a very long time to sign it, because I wasn't sure. I was like, I don't want to sign to someone if I'm not 100% on this journey, you know. And it took about, I was just under a year, and eventually I was like, okay, I'm ready. Like, let's do it. I had a few more songs and I was just like, let's go. So yeah, then I became an artist again.
It's kind of weird, because actually the way you've done it is actually you know having had experience and stuff in your second record deal, it's basically like you took some time and you didn't rush into it, and you said, no, I haven't, you know. And you're already more established, you've now written some hits and stuff for other people. Like, you have way more clout and way more reason to say, no, I'm going to do this. But you took your time and stuff, and that's really important, because especially for people getting into the music business who want to get into it, it's really easy to rush and take the first thing that you're offered. Completely. And sometimes you kind of sometimes you have to, you know. Like, my first deal, publishing that I had, was terrible. Like, the terms are terrible, you know, like, all that stuff. But like, had I not done that, I might not be doing music for a living, you know. So
I think, just to like add to what you said as well, I think this industry is very much a foot in the door industry, you know. Everyone says that you have to be lucky, and I think you do. There's an element of luck, but then I really believe that it's what you do with that luck, you know. So this time, like the second time I'd kind of been with a record label, I was like, right, no one gets two record deals. Like, lightning doesn't strike twice. I was like, this time I have to literally run with it, because I'm never going to get this again. And we just said, like, let's really go. Like, let's just write all the time. Go on tours, like, post on Instagram every single day of your life. Because that's like a whole nother thing as well, that from Chasing Grace, social media was only just kind of picking up. So that wasn't like a problem at that time, really. We were just posting every now and then and stuff. But now we're at a time where social media is like the forefront of being an artist, because everyone wants to see what you're doing every day. And I really struggled with that, as I know a lot of people do. I couldn't talk to the camera. Like, my team were like, you have to talk to the camera. I was like, I can't do that. That's so weird. Like, it's such a strange thing. So I had to teach myself, talk to these people that you're fans. Like, so I kind of just wrote some songs. I went on tour with like Alec Benjamin, Nina Nesbitt, Maisie Peters, some amazing artists. And I picked up a fan base from that. And I finally realized that if I was just myself, people would kind of connect with that. And I'd never knew that before, because I was always just like, oh, you have to be an artist, you have to be this, and you have to wear certain clothes, and you have to sing certain words. But I realized that people actually just want to connect with emotional songs, and they just kind of want to see you for you. So I just took that stance. I started putting songs out that came from the heart, and they're like very honest to what I'd been going through. And people seem to connect with that more than ever. And I just really enjoyed it, you know. It's just kind of been this journey where I've just been building and building, you know. I don't think I'm ever going to be the type of artist that is like a huge pop star. I'm not going to be in magazines or anything like that. I just kind of want to put out good songs so that people can connect and kind of like feel like someone's going through the same thing, you know.
And when you're supporting these people on tour and stuff, standing in front of thousands of people and stuff, like, how did that compare to being in your previous band? And were there more nerves and stuff? Was there a big higher expectation? Like, okay, now I'm properly doing, like you say, I've probably got to make this work now. Like, what was the feeling when you took your guitar and stepped in front of the mic and opened your mouth?
I always remember the first show I played by myself. It was horrendous, because I very quickly realized, but when you're in a band, there's obviously four people on stage, four or five people, and there's a lot of people for the audience to look at. Yeah. So when I'm like, need a moment to like take a sip of water or tune up my guitar, like, people can watch my band members. Yeah. But then when you go on stage by yourself, you very quickly realize that at all times, people are watching you. So every time you take a drink, every time you take a breath, everyone's just like, what's he doing? Right? And I realized that. And it was like, all of a sudden between songs, I had to speak every time. I had to have good like stories behind the songs, and I had to have jokes. My jokes are awful. You know, and all of a sudden it was like very much like, okay, I'm a one-man band. This is it now. It took a lot to get used to it, you know, but I think once you do, you kind of enjoy and you realize that that's your home, your stage is your home, and you're kind of inviting people into your home. So I love it.
Do you feel like taking your songs on stage, you realize what works and what doesn't? And does that also affect how you then go back and write when you need to write, say, like another album or something, or an EP? Like, are you saying, okay, this kind of style didn't work, or this kind of lyric didn't work? Like how much of that feedback do you sort of take on, or are you even aware of that? Or, like, you know, how does that work? Is it different for everyone?
I think it does. I think you always kind of notice the songs that get a reaction. And the songs that don't get a reaction, you're always going to notice that, especially when you're the support artist. Sure. I think that is very important to kind of go through, because it can be very tough. You know, you're playing to an audience that don't necessarily want to watch you. They're not there for you. So you have to win them over. 2019, I did about 3 months worth of touring as a support act. And that was like literally rites of passage of like, I need to win as many people over as possible, because this is how I'm going to get my fan base. And I kind of just went on stage and I realized that the songs with like the big choruses always seem to catch people's attention, because you're just shouting at them. Literally, it's like if you go into a room and you just talk to people, obviously there's a few people are going to like catch your eye and everything. If you go into a room and shout, then people are obviously going to stop and be like, okay, what's going on here? So I realized that the big choruses, the kind of louder songs, always seem to catch people. I always sing a cover of a song that I've written. So Little Mix Touch was my song for a bit. When I go to Europe and America, I sing Kygo, Remind Me to Forget. And I feel like just that bit of familiarity for people to connect with as a support artist is very important. Just singing a cover, just to kind of, so that they can be like, oh, okay, like, I get what this person's about, you know?
That's so interesting. I remember seeing Prince live in Kent, of all places.
And wow.
Classic, like the coolest guy music, and yeah, in Kent, in a field somewhere. And he was honestly that had the best soundtrack. He did a live soundtrack and it was just amazing. So then he then stopped mid-set and just went, "This next song bought me a house," and started playing his version of Sinead O'Connor's "Nothing Compares," and which is very different from her version. But it was it was really funny because a lot of people don't know he wrote that for her. When you're writing songs, when you go into a studio, do you always know what you want to write about? Like, how does that work? How does your songwriting process work?
I tend to, well, every day is different, as you know. Every song is different. But what seems to work best for me is if I have like a phrase or a word, I always tend to kind of go in and be like, "Yo, I've got this idea." And even if everyone's just like, "Nah, that's not good enough," it starts a conversation. So I have like on my phone, I have like a note page that just has so many lines and just random words, and probably 99% of them are awful. But it just kind of like gives you that moment of like hit the ground running. I kind of watch films to get inspiration. So like, for example, I have a song called Lost for Words. And in the chorus, it starts with, "I've never told anybody this before." And I basically watched 500 Days of Summer, which is one of my favorite films. Really good for songwriting, that film. If you haven't seen that film and want to write songs, go watch it. And there's a line, basically, Zooey Deschanel says, "I've never told anybody this before, blah, 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 blah." And I was just like, that is such a good line. Why has no one ever sung that before? I was just like, went into the room. I was like, "I never told anybody before." I was like, yes. And honestly, and a lot of that, and Little Mix Touch, like, "I had just a touch of your love." I was just like, that's a cool line. Like, maybe there's something in that. Remind me to forget. So I kind of find like things like that, it just gives you the backbone to kind of build the rest of the skeleton around, which is cool.
Starting the conversation thing, I think, is a really important point, because it's not as if, you know, A, you're not coming in with the song fully formed. You know, you're saying a title might be used, a phrase might not be used, you know. Quite often, I mean, in my experience, is like, yeah, quite often things will work, they'll work their way out as they are going to be, you know, in the end, as if it's almost fate has decided what it's going to be. And sometimes you look back at the title and you think, that's not even in the song now, but that title, we never would have written the song.
You know? Exactly.
What's your mindset when you go into a room, or when you're just writing on your own and stuff, and things aren't going well, you know? Because obviously, we know, you've had so much success so far in your career already, and like, but how is it on those days where it's not happening?
I actually get that a lot. I think about at least once a month, I'll be like, "I'm rubbish. I'm actually terrible. I can't do this. How, like, this isn't my job. I need to find a new job." Like, at least once a month. That's just a natural thing. I get writer's block like every week, you know. There's just like, there'll be one or two days where you just kind of like, "I'm not feeling it today." And inspiration is like, it's one of those things that come and go, you know. It's, you can't force a song, you know. So I tend to just take a step back. If it's not working, it's not working. There's nothing wrong with that. I believe that writing a song with someone is just a weird thing as it is. Like, that's so unnatural. 9 times out of 10, when you're meeting someone new and you're like, "Hi, nice to meet you," and then you just start singing at them, like, that's crazy.
Weird.
So to even kind of write a song in the first place is an amazing thing. So I'm just kind of like, look, if it's not working, take a step back, take a break. You can like take an hour break and come back, or you could just stop and do it another day. There's a lot of days in a year, and you're not going to write a good song every day.
Yeah, like, kind of lastly, like, your latest crazy big hit is Before You Go for Lewis Capaldi.
Yeah.
You'd written before for Lewis, but so how did that song come about, and what was the impetus behind the song?
So I met Lewis, we wrote Hollywood together first. I was very lucky because two good friends of mine, JC Stewart, who is an amazing artist and writer, and Kane, obviously. JC had text Kane just like, "Yo, Lewis wants to write tonight. And are you available?" Kane was like, "Yeah." And then Kane texts me. He was like, "You available?" And I just happened to be doing nothing. So I was like, "Yeah, of course, I'm down." This was before Lewis, like, I think Bruises was out. Mm-hmm. He had a few songs out, and I just loved him. He wasn't like hugely famous or anything like that yet. But when I hear a good voice, I'm just like, I definitely want to work with that person, 100%. So we came to the studio and we started at like 11 p.m. And we just wrote until like 4 a.m. Kind of one of those days, but... or nights, I should say. But we wrote Hollywood. And I think that's key, because that was my kind of like meeting Lewis and just becoming friends and getting to know him. And then there was a session with TMS that Lewis was having, and they basically just asked if I was available to come and just join, just to have some fun. And thankfully I said yes, and I went down, and Lewis just really opened up, and he was like, I want to write a song about something that I've never really spoken about before, because the song is actually about suicide, which is an amazing thing, because to write a pop song about something that's so important and so to the heart is, you know, you don't get to do that often. So he was like, basically, I don't think he actually mentioned who it was in the session, but he was like, someone I know very close to me, like, committed suicide a while ago. And I just want to talk about that, basically. And we just wrote the song, and it was an amazing song. And I just think it's one of those ones where it just kind of like was in the emails, and everyone kind of just left it as it was for a bit. The album came out, it wasn't the album. And then I got an email one day just like, oh, by the way, they're doing a repackage of the album, and they're looking at using Before You Go. So we basically did some tweaks on it, and we did some backing vocals and just made it sound a little bit more grand. And then, yeah, they were like, this is going to be the single for the repackage. And lo and behold, it went to radio, and it just kind of seemed to really connect with people, which I feel very, very, very grateful for. And it's, as I say, like, it's nice to have a song that really means something. I'm really happy. And that was my first official number one, I think.
Yeah.
Which like, what?
Yeah.
I can't believe it. I'm never going to I have like one of the number one trophies downstairs, and I look at it every day like, how did that even happen? What is going on? You know?
It's really interesting for me to hear these kind of stories of like the route to a number one record, you know, like you were invited to something, you were like, yeah, okay, I'll come along and do that. And then, like you say, it was kind of shelved and forgotten about. And I'm sort of sitting here thinking, they did what with it? Like, you know, and it's kind of is what it is. Like, and this kind of, you might have like 10 more number ones on your hard drive that people have forgotten about, or in an email chain, you know, and people are going to scoop out, especially now you've had this as well, you know, timing as well. It's like such a big thing of any success in any field, I guess. Obviously, like you said, you got to put the work in, and it's the product in itself has got to be amazing, first of all. Otherwise, if it wasn't a good song, it wouldn't have done anything. What do you prefer, the studio or the stage?
Oh, this is a question that a lot of people ask me. I think the studio. I'm not that kind of guy that wants to be famous. I like to be creative, and I like the idea of making art. I'll always have a place in my heart to be on stage and to connect with my fans, because you should never take that for granted. That is an incredible thing. But just to be in a studio, eating snacks, drinking coffee, there's nothing better than that. Like, there really is nothing better than that. And just like having the best conversations with people that you've never met before. Because like, what other world would you get that, you know? Just having like deep, deep conversations, getting to know people. I love it a lot. I love it. And I'm never going to stop writing songs.
Amazing. What does the next year look like for you?
Next year, so I've got a few songs on the horizon with other artists, which I'm excited about. Fingers crossed they come out. We don't know yet. I was meant to be going on tour, but obviously that's gonna have to wait a little bit. So right now, I'm going to keep my head down. I'm going to write an album for myself. Amazing. Try and write some albums for some other people and just get as many songs out in the world as possible, I think.
Well, thank you so much. This has been beyond illuminating, and I'm sure everyone's going to find your insights really fascinating. So thank you very much.
Thank you, bro. Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.